This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
The Global News podcast brings you the latest on the ceasefire and hostage release. We hear from our correspondent in Tel Aviv, where three Israeli women just released by Hamas after 15 months in captivity are being taken to hospital for medical checks. From the West Bank, where dozens of Palestinians held in Israeli prisons are being released. And from Gaza, as people return to what's left of their homes to rebuild. Find us wherever you find your podcasts.
Hello and welcome to NewsHour from the BBC World Service, coming to you live from London. I'm James Kamarasamy. An explosion of joy in Israel today as the family of 24-year-old Romy Gonen watched footage of her release. In a video released by the IDF, her father can be seen jumping in the air before breaking down in tears. Together with 31-year-old Dori Steinbrecher and 28-year-old Emily Damari, she was handed over by Hamas, the first three hostages to be freed under the terms of a ceasefire deal, which came into force today after a short delay. Those were the pretty chaotic scenes in Gaza as the three women were ushered into a Red Cross convoy before being escorted back to Israeli territory. Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu saluted their release.
To Romy, Doron and Emily, a whole nation embraces you with congratulations on your return home. I know, we all know, they have been through hell. They are coming out of darkness into light. They are literally coming out of slavery into freedom.
It's a transition that will not be easy. The women, the first of 33 hostages due to be released in the first six-week phase of this agreement, were reunited with their mothers before being flown by military helicopter to a hospital on the outskirts of Tel Aviv, where other family members were waiting for them. In the past half hour, doctors have said that the women are in a stable condition. In Gaza, meanwhile, thousands of displaced people, clutching tents, clothes and other belongings, began to head back to their homes as the skies above them fell quiet and the bombs and drones stopped falling. These Palestinians who returned to their homes in Rafah said they were shocked to see the level of destruction.
Everything was destroyed. There's nothing left. It's as if there's been an earthquake.
We did not expect all this destruction in Rafah. We'd been building our home for 20 years, and in a moment, it was destroyed, just like that.
Well, we can speak now to the BBC's Jonah Fisher, who's in Israel. Well, what a day for the people of Israel, Jonah. First of all, that delay to the ceasefire deal coming into force, and at the end, these amazing pictures of the hostages, the freed hostages, reunited with their families.
Yeah, I've spent the day outside the Sheba Medical Center in Tel Aviv, which is where the hostages ended up this evening in emotional scenes inside as they were reunited with their friends. It's been quite a day. As you said, it started off with an argument between Hamas over whether the names of these three hostages had been released. The start of this ceasefire for several hours, but eventually the names were provided, and we saw the extraordinary scenes in Gaza as Hamas fighters, masked Hamas fighters, handed over the three women to the Red Cross, and then the Red Cross proceeded to take them away and hand them over to the IDF, and they were flown out. So emotional scenes just outside Gaza, where the three women, Dori, Emily and Romy, were reunited with their mothers who'd been brought there for that moment. And then again at this hospital in Tel Aviv, where there were much bigger groups of their friends and families. And really, that's where the tears really flowed, and they're incredibly emotional scenes, obviously, for those hostages. It's been a terrible 15 months, but also for the friends and family who've been really clinging to every little fragment of information, any indication that they were alive during that time.
And we heard just a minute ago the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu welcoming them back. But for him, I mean, the cloud over today has been the fact that he's lost one government minister and he's got another one essentially saying, look, if we don't resume the fighting, I'll go as well.
Well, there is that cloud over him, and that's been hovering over him for quite a few days with the threats of these far-right extremist ministers to quit the government. Indeed, one of them has gone ahead and quit the government. The other one is threatening to quit the government if war doesn't resume in 6 months' time. I think possibly the biggest cloud actually to emerge from today is the optics of what we saw unfold in Gaza today. Remember, Israel went to war in Gaza to eliminate, to destroy Hamas. And what we saw visually in the pictures that emerged was that, Hamas was very much still there. Israel has negotiated this arrangement with Hamas, and it may have been something of a PR stunt, but they would enforce for this handover. So there's no way really that Israel can sell this as a total military victory when the whole of this country is deserving the Hamas fighters back on the street of Gaza.
Jonah, thanks very much. Jonah Fisher there live for us, and apologies for the quality of the line there. Well, we can put that point that Jonah was making now to Lieutenant Colonel Peter Lerner, spokesman for the Israeli Defence Forces, who joins us live. Welcome back to NewsHour. What about that point that Jonah's made about the optics? Hamas, it does not look to be defeated in Gaza. What's your point of view?
Good evening, James. Indeed, we embarked on this operation, this war, on the 7th of October because Hamas decided to launch an invasion into Israel. We wouldn't have had to go to war against Hamas in order to bring back the 250 hostages if it was not for them. Indeed, they had been preparing for that day for some 16 years, built up a huge force, a huge capability. And when we mobilized on the 7th in retaliation for their invasion, we knew it would take time. So, of course, they still have control. They still have, and as we've said throughout the course of almost 15 months now, they still have the ability to end the war by releasing the hostages. They chose not to do so until now. And today, I think you talked about the father jumping up and down to the images of his daughter. I think it was everybody whose hearts lost a beat today in Israel, seeing Emily Doron and Romy Gonen, whose only sin was to either be lying in bed in the morning on the 7th of October or dancing with friends at a music festival. So I think what I can say is that over the next 7 days, these next 7 days until the next exchange is supposed to happen, can't pass quick enough. Israel wants the hostages home. This framework agreement is supposed to deliver a total of 33, as you rightly pointed out. But we definitely want all 94 hostages home, and we want them now.
What then about Hamas? Because Antony Blinken, the US Secretary of State, said just a few days ago, Hamas has recruited as many fighters as it has lost in the attacks that the IDF has carried out. That does not seem to bode well for this ceasefire turning into something more permanent.
So, the IDF takes its instructions from the government. If the government has instructed, and those two goals of dismantling Hamas as a governing authority with terrorist or military capabilities is an unacceptable reality. We saw what they did with those powers on the 7th of October, and therefore the government instructed us to dismantle those capabilities, and we will continue to operate, as we will see as the progress of this framework continues. We'll be able to see if we will be able to continue to bring home hostages through negotiations, or we'll have to mobilize the military once more on the ground.
Yeah. So for the time being, what can you tell us about what the IDF's stance is in and around Gaza?
We are currently in defensive positions. We've over the next 7 days, we have taken up positions and they are defensive, and we've exited a lot of the northern areas. But taken defensive positions around the border area in the Tzarim corridor, the corridor of the Philadelphia corridor, that's that border between Gaza Strip and Egypt. These are the positions agreed upon in the framework of the negotiations together with the mediators. And these are the positions we've taken up. And I expect there to be some movement, removing some of the forces in Tzarim over the next 7 days or in 7 days' time. I think this is what we will be continuing to do. They will be defensive in essence. And of course, we won't take any threats. Any threats will be met by force.
Lieutenant Colonel Peter Lerner, spokesman for the IDF, thanks very much. Well, one of the Israeli hostages released today was Emily Demari. She's an Israeli and a British national. Many of her family are in the UK still. They've been campaigning for her release. The BBC's Lucy Manning went to North London, where they live. She spoke to Tony Moss. He's Emily's cousin. And Lucy asked him for his reaction to her release.
We're just overjoyed, lost for words. Can't quite believe it. Didn't think it was going to happen and that should be first out. We just can't quite believe it. But we're also sad. This is just the beginning. We need to get the other hostages out. We can be happy today for Emily and Mandy and the family and the other hostages that have been released. But this is just the beginning. We've got to get all the hostages out.
What does it mean to you after this long ordeal that Emily is now home?
Oh, just huge relief. Huge relief. Just there's been an anxiety for 471 days, a huge anxiety that we're all carrying around with us, and we can let that go now, but only in respect of Emily. But we've got to get the other hostages out. I know I keep saying that, but we do.
And what were your emotions when you heard the news and when you saw the pictures?
I broke down when I saw the pictures. When I saw the pictures, only once Emily was in the hands of her mother, Mandy. Because you saw how fragile it was when they were in Gaza, surrounded by Hamas terrorists and mobs. That was still extremely fragile. Anything could have happened. But once she was in the hands, back over the border and in the hands of her mother where she should have been, then just huge relief. Then I broke down in tears.
And that photo of Emily smiling with her mum, Mandy.
Amazing, absolutely amazing. Even though you saw she's got some fingers missing, that she was shot on the day she was taken. They shot her dog dead and shot her fingers. But she's still smiling. She's smiling. She's an amazing spirit, Emily. And may that be hope for the other hostages and their families.
And what has been the discussion in the family chat group with Mandy?
There's only one thing under discussion. And this morning, first thing when we heard the news, Mandy sent a message to the family WhatsApp group that she's packed a bag and she's waiting to hear where and when. But she won't believe it until she's got her in her arms. She refused to believe until it happened.
And what was the message when Emily was released?
She's here. You know, Mandy's got this special thing with her daughter Emily about a hug for 40 seconds, because it takes 40 seconds for the dopamine to be released. So she just was waiting for that hug for 471 days. That's a long time. But now we need to hug the other hostages. We need to get them out.
What have the last months, more than a year, felt like?
Just hugely stressful. Anxiety, stress, turmoil. Ending for us now in respect of Emily, but not for those other families. So bring them home.
And those pictures, it seemed that Emily was in, it seemed on the surface, pretty good spirits.
No, it's just the start. Who knows what mental conditions she's in, but she's alive, she was smiling. This is, you know, this is the beginning, and thank God she's home to her mum and her brothers.
Tony Moss, the cousin of Emily Demari, one of the hostages released today, speaking to Lucy Manning. We'll be hearing for the Palestinians shortly. You're listening to NewsHour. Coming up later on, as the first Israeli hostages are released from captivity in Gaza, we hear from a doctor who treated very young hostages who were released during the first exchange of hostages more than a year ago.
He had, you know, like a quarter of a pita bread in his hand. And he didn't bite it. He didn't give in even one bite. And I asked him, why don't you eat? So he looked at me, and he's a four-year-old. He looked at me and said, I'm keeping it for tomorrow.
That's coming up later on. The headlines at this hour. Doctors in Tel Aviv say the three women hostages released by Hamas as part of a ceasefire deal with Israel are in a stable condition. Meanwhile, in the occupied West Bank, crowds have gathered outside Ofer prison to see the first 90 Palestinian prisoners freed in exchange for the three Israelis. We'll be hearing from there shortly. And one other piece of news, TikTok's been restored in the United States after Donald Trump said he would allow the app to return. You're listening to the BBC World Service. This is NewsHour, coming to you live from London with James Kamarasamy. Well, let's turn to the Palestinian side of things now, because thousands of displaced Gazans have begun returning to their homes, or what's left of them today. And aid trucks have also entered the territory to deliver much-needed humanitarian aid. Under the terms of the ceasefire deal, at least 600 vehicles are due to cross into Gaza each day. Well, earlier we heard about the mother and daughter reunions of the three Israeli hostages released by Hamas. There are also Palestinians who hope this ceasefire means the end of their enforced separation from their families. They include Farida Adel. She's a Palestinian teacher who's had to move several times since the war began. Her parents and siblings are in northern Gaza. She is in Deir al-Balah in the south of the Strip. So how does she feel about the ceasefire?
I have mixed feelings about the ceasefire, happiness and relief. I need just to go to the north to see my parents because, as you know, I evacuated to the south with my nephews, but the rest of my family is still in the north.
And are you confident now that you will be able to get back and see them?
To be honest with you, I don't know if this is a real ceasefire or if this is the end of the war. We have seen things fall apart before, but I hope this time it's real more than anything. I had to be a big hope inside to go back on Saturday because they get us 1 week to prepare ourselves to get back there.
And are there people who are in the same place as you who are already going back, who have decided already to go back?
All the people here, and there's a lot of feelings, a lot of passion to return to the north. My home is still in the north, though it has been destroyed, and we know all of our homes are destroyed. But that doesn't matter now. What matters most is that my family, my mother, my father, my siblings are still alive. So we can rebuild everything. We can rebuild our homes, our dreams, everything.
And you are hopeful that you will see them soon?
Look, I cannot sleep. I cannot eat. I cannot do anything. I'm just waiting. Even I know it destroyed, but it doesn't matter. We will have our tent and put it on our land there in the north.
And what has it been like without the sound of aircraft and drones above you today?
I feel comfortable, more comfortable. I feel safe. Just your head like so calm and you don't need anything now. You feel like I'm a queen. I have my cup of coffee.
Can you remember when you felt this way the last time?
Before 7 October, I forget what does save life mean. But now I'm just remembering. I didn't remember anything before 7th of October. I'm just remembering after this date. I just remember my friend's voice. Those are martyrs. I just remember the sound of the drones. I just feel I will return to the north and I will see all of them after all of these days, more than 470 days of blood, of death, of evacuating.
What do you think the future holds for you, Farida?
The future of Gaza is uncertain, unfortunately. But I believe we must try to rebuild it. I established more than 12 educational tents for my students during the genocidal war. My goal now is to return to the north and continue this mission and this passion with my students. No matter how difficult things become, I will not leave Gaza forever because I believe in myself and this city. Now I belong to Gaza, just Gaza.
That was Palestinian teacher Farida Adel, and she was speaking to me from southern Gaza. Well, we heard about the release of the Israeli hostages. Crowds, meanwhile, have gathered around the Ofer prison in the occupied West Bank ahead of the expected release of 90 Palestinians, most of them women, in exchange for those Israeli hostages. Let's speak now to the freelance Palestinian journalist Sama Shalabi, former head of the Foreign Press Association in Ramallah. You've been to the prison today, haven't you? What's the atmosphere there been like, Sama?
Hi, Kirsten. I didn't go to the prison itself. We were like allowed to go to the area where the prison is, which is we could see it from distance. The atmosphere there is not normal. A mixed of feelings between the families. A lot of families gathering down there, all of it with mixed feelings. You speak with the families down there, all of them like they are happy for the release of their lovers. Lovers and they're going to meet them. And they are more happy for the ceasefire itself, for like the stopping of killing in Gaza.
Just to be clear, is there a list? Is there a definitive list? Do those relatives who've gone to the prison, are they certain that the people they are waiting for will be released as part of this first wave of releases?
Yes, it's like the list was released around 4:30, between 4:35, they received the list. So everyone was sure who's going to be released. But even not just the families themselves who's there, like everyone from villages, from cities, from I saw people coming from Jenin, I saw people coming from Hebron. They know that there is somebody who will be released from these areas, but like they come. When I ask them, like, why you are here? They say that we're coming here to celebrate, to see people coming out to celebrate with our people, and to make sure that it is really starting the ceasefire.
And what is going to happen to the prisoners who are released? I understand some of them are going to be sent abroad.
Not from the first, like those people who's the 90 people who's coming up today, no. All of them, they're going home. But like what I understand, there's a few of them who's like was released in the Shalit time, and they were arrested again.
Released in exchange for the Israeli soldier,
Galad Shalit. When those people who was arrested after they were released, they're speaking about they're going to send them outside the country. I don't know where to, but there's information saying either to Turkey or to Qatar, but still not confirmed yet. They're speaking about 48 to 49 people. Or 49 prisoners. Not sure exactly the number, how many will be expanded outside the country, but still there's a lot of them. I did hear about that there's a lot of prisoners who refuse to be out, to go outside. For example, I did hear about Marwan Barghouti, who's going to, they're speaking about releasing him and Ahmed Saadat. They're going to release him the second stage of the negotiation, like after this 42 days when they start the negotiation for the second stage. They asked that they will deport them outside the country. They understand from lawyers and from families from them that they are refusing to be going out. Either
because
like
they want to be part of the new political leadership, do they, presumably?
Absolutely, and I think that's somebody like Marwan Barghouti, he could be the main leader of the Palestinian, and he's the kind of person who could make united the Palestinians.
Sama, thanks for bringing us up to date with that. We await the release of those prisoners. Sama Shalabi there in the West Bank. You're listening to NewsHour.
The Global News podcast brings you the latest on the ceasefire and hostage release. We hear from our correspondent in Tel Aviv, where three Israeli women just released by Hamas after 15 months in captivity are being taken to hospital for medical checks. From the West Bank, where dozens of Palestinians held in Israeli prisons are being released. And from Gaza, as people return to what's left of their homes to rebuild. Find us wherever you find your podcasts.
Welcome back to NewsHour. Coming up next, we'll be in Washington, D.C., ahead of tomorrow's inauguration of Donald Trump, to hear about the mood among his supporters. First, though, an American perspective on the day's events in the Middle East and the prospects for this current ceasefire. Thomas Nides was the U.S. ambassador to Israel during the first 2 years of the Biden administration. So how confident is he that the deal will hold during this first 6-week phase?
James, I'm relatively confident because I think ultimately this deal was brokered by both the Biden and Trump administration with the Qataris and obviously with the Israelis. And so I'm relatively confident. But listen, we're dealing with a terrorist organization. We're dealing with Hamas. You know, you saw the pictures today. The Hamas is trying to assert themselves and certainly in all the TV coverage this morning. But my hope is and my prayer is that we'll get this first phase done.
Because certainly in the longer term, the mood music from Benjamin Netanyahu and others is, look, this is temporary. This could, and indeed some of his cap, at least one member of his cabinet, Mr. Smotrich, has said, look, if fighting doesn't resume in 6 weeks' time, I'm off. And that's a political danger for him, isn't it? Do you think a return to some kind of fighting is inevitable?
Listen, Netanyahu's going to have to, he's good at this. He's the master. He's going to have to manage Ben-Gavir and Smotrich.
He hasn't managed Ben-Gavir. He's out, isn't he?
Yeah,
already?
But, you know, at the end of the day, these guys, he's going to have to manage these guys, okay? This is Netanyahu's responsibility. And so he's got, on the one hand, he's got Smotrich and Ben-Gavir. On the other hand, he's got Donald Trump and the hostage family. So he is going to have to pull the magic, which, you know, he's capable of doing, but he's going to have to do it. And there's no question that this is not going to be easy. It's not going to be a straight line, but he needs to get it done.
What do you make of the Secretary of State, the outgoing Secretary of State, Antony Blinken's assessment that Hamas have recruited almost as many new fighters as they have lost over the past 15 months? That doesn't really bode well for the near future, does it?
Well, I think people are misinterpreting that a little bit. Okay, people can, quote, volunteer to sign up. I think that the Israel has done a spectacular job dismantling the capabilities of Hamas, meaning ammunition, their weaponry. They've dismantled much of the tunnels and the network. Can they recruit people? Sure, they can recruit people. I don't think that's ever been a question. The question is, do they have the capacity to repeat what they did on October 7th? I think the answer to that is no. They cannot. But this is going to be part of it. And as Tony has said, or Secretary Blinken has said numerous times, the solution here is a reformed Palestinian authority to keep the peace and to run Gaza. The answer is not having an Israeli occupation of Gaza. That is the only way, with by the way, the help of the Emiratis and the Qataris and obviously the Saudis. But that's the only way we're going to sustain this over the long term.
The assessment there of Thomas Nides, who was the US ambassador to Israel between 2021 and 2023. You're listening to the BBC World Service. This is NewsHour, coming to you live from London with James Kamara-Sami. There will presumably be no arguments about crowd size this time. Tomorrow, Donald Trump will follow in the footsteps of Ronald Reagan and be inaugurated for a second time indoors. He was brought by government plane to a chilly Washington, D.C. this weekend for a final pre-inauguration rally today. NewsHour's Nuala McGovern is at the Capital One Arena where it's taking place. And a short while ago, she joined me from there and told me what the mood was like.
It's jubilant, I think is the word. It's very lively. You can probably hear a lot of people chattering around me. There's a huge queue to the right of me, and they are people in ponchos and red hats, everybody with the slogan Make America Great, or MAGA as it's often shortened to, trying to make their way into the Capital One Arena here in Chinatown in Washington, D.C., because Donald Trump, president-elect until tomorrow, is expected to address the crowd in about less than an hour from now. So there's also a sense of excitement. I should also say that all of this is happening in the freezing, pouring rain, but these people remain undeterred. They got up at the crack of dawn, some that will make it inside, and others instead that perhaps are thinking today may not be the day that they get to see the leader of the Republican Party. Now, I have a couple of gentlemen that are here beside me, Jason and Sean. You were queuing up, Jason, correct?
We actually were. We just came down here. We knew we weren't going to get in, so we're just viewing everybody.
Now, you are in the attire. You have the red. This is a very popular hat in DC this weekend. It's a red bobble hat with Trump across it, 45 across the brow. So you are a Trump supporter and felt the need to make quite a long journey, even just to soak up the atmosphere, even if you're not going to make it into the arena for the rally.
Correct. Well, our plans changed. Originally, we were supposed to be in the mall. I think we could have viewed it a lot better. But for reasons unknown, I think, the location got changed.
You don't just think it's the bad weather? It's going to be like minus 11 Celsius, keep my American on, 11 Fahrenheit.
Right. 24 is what I saw, above zero, and I don't think that's too bad.
Okay, so you would prefer if you came out. So a bit of disappointment, I suppose.
A bit of a disappointment, but it's still going to be great.
Sean is also here, who traveled with Jason. What is it about Mr. Trump that would make you make that journey and to be part of his second inauguration?
Well, on his first term as president, I don't think he was given a fair chance. And I want to see our country succeed and be great again. And that's why we made the journey.
Lower energy prices.
Okay, hold on. Let us return. You were talking about there, for example, Jason, that it's lower energy prices is the thing that you think is going to change?
Lower energy prices will change everything. That, and let's do some exposing of the deep state. Let's tell the truth about 9/11. And did we really land on the moon?
So you have a lot of things that you don't think really happened.
Correct. Well, 9/11 happened, but not the story that the media portrayed.
Okay. Let me turn back to your journey that you have made here, all the way from how far did you come?
About 1,000 miles.
And tomorrow, where will you spend it?
Down by the mall, where the parade route was supposed to start.
And what it means to be here? I mean, who are you speaking to? What is the mood, as you describe it, for people that aren't in Washington, D.C.?
A bunch of people, a bunch of like-minded people with pride for the United States of America.
I think the crowd to the right of me continues to flow, hoping that they will make it into the Capital One Arena to catch a glimpse of Donald Trump. Tomorrow he's also going to go to that arena after his inauguration, as he will not be, of course, outside, as Jason and Sean are very sad to report. They're disappointed that they won't be able to see him closer to them in the way it has traditionally been. I think Ronald Reagan was the last president that took it inside back in 1985. So it's quite something to behold, to see this usually true blue city, meaning a Democrat city, become instead surrounded, immersed with Republicans, really here to welcome back Donald Trump to the White House.
Anula, tell us about your movements on, as you say, an unconventional inauguration day.
Well, tomorrow we will be broadcasting NewsHour from 1400 GMT. That will be in advance of the inaugural address. A number of people that will be joining us, the evangelical Christian preacher, Franklin Graham, for example. Of course, he is the son of Billy Graham. He's going to be giving the prayer tomorrow. I've been speaking to him. He does get nervous before such events that people might be surprised to hear. Also, we're going to have BBC correspondents, not only across DC, but also across the United States. Some are expecting swift action when it comes to executive orders from Donald Trump just in the hours after his address, including on immigration. So that will be some of the discussions that will be starting really quickly. We will also, I suppose, a lot of it is unknown because it is inside and in the Capitol Rotunda, to see where do these people go, how will they celebrate. But we will be on the BBC World Service throughout the day, NewsHour leading into special programming that will also take the address, and back again at 2000 GMT for a late edition of NewsHour, where we will talk, of course, about what happened. It'll be interesting to see exactly the tone of Donald Trump's inaugural speech. Will it echo 2017 when he talked about American carnage? Or will there be a more optimistic note like Morning in America, which, of course, Ronald Reagan used and Donald Trump often compares himself to?
NewsHour's Nuala McGovern speaking to me from the Capital One Arena in Washington, D.C. So, as the 45th President of the United States prepares to also become the 47th, what about the 46th? Well, history will recall that Joe Biden beat Donald Trump once and thought he could beat him again, but found his re-election attempt thwarted by a growing sense of his physical and mental frailty. On his last full day in office, Mr. Biden took part in events honouring the civil rights leader Martin Luther King in South Carolina, and he once again spoke of America's role in bringing about the ceasefire in Gaza and helping to reshape the Middle East.
Now the region has been fundamentally transformed. Hamas's longtime leader, Sinwar, is dead. Hamas sponsors in the Middle East have been badly weakened by Israel, backed by the United States. Hezbollah, one of Hamas's biggest backers, was significantly weakened on the battlefield, and its leadership was destroyed.
Well, for a broader assessment of Joe Biden's term in office, I turned to David Greenberg, Professor of History and of Journalism and Media Studies at Rutgers University. So how does he think history will judge Joe Biden's presidency?
Well, I think probably quite well overall. I do think his support for Ukraine and support for Israel were both to be admired and both part of a larger defense of the international liberal rules-based order as we've come to honor it for the last 75 or 80 years. But I think his loss to Trump calls into question even those otherwise successful policies. We don't know, and we have reason to suspect, that Trump will try to resolve the Russian invasion of Ukraine on terms less favorable to Ukraine. And we really can't predict what Trump will do in the Middle East, but he has always been sort of a wild card there as well.
What about Afghanistan? Because he was someone who had long wanted to pull out of Afghanistan. He tried and failed to win that battle when he was vice president. But the manner in which America withdrew certainly did his foreign policy credentials a lot of damage, wouldn't you say?
No question about it. You know, American liberal internationalists have been in a dilemma really ever since Vietnam, but, you know, especially since Iraq, which is how to kind of avoid the militarism and aggressiveness of the posture of, say, a George W. Bush invading other countries and getting militarily bogged down, without forsaking American leadership on the world stage, which a kind of depressing number of Democrats in the United States now see as the better course. Biden hoped to do that in Afghanistan, but I think in the end, the failure of planning, really the failure to size up the situation for what it was, and this is a problem I see with Biden with some other domestic problems as well. You know, he was never the best analyst. He was never the visionary. He was always more of a workhorse who had good underlying principles and could follow through on them, but you never knew when things would throw a curveball, and that was never his strength, hitting the curveball.
What about the fact that he spoke so often about Donald Trump as a threat to democracy? Contrast that, and I think you have done, with what he did or didn't do while he was in office to perhaps ring-fence democracy. He talks a lot about it, but
right.
he didn't really do very much. Is that, again, something that might come to be part of his legacy?
Very much so. The crisis that we are in really called for a Franklin Roosevelt. What we got is a Biden, a very well-intentioned, liberal-minded man, you know, certainly competent, but not someone who rose to the occasion the way FDR had. And in particular, the public aspect of presidential leadership, which has been a key component of being president since Teddy Roosevelt and Woodrow Wilson. You have to be out there making the case, winning people over, maintaining morale and support. And Biden, perhaps because of his declining capacities, really did not play that role. If Trump was a president we saw and heard far too much of, Biden was a president we saw and heard far too little of. And that really kept him, I think, from commanding the support that he needed to sustain throughout his 4 years.
Yet, just as a final thought, ironically, that is what people rather welcomed at the beginning. They wanted a president in the background. They're tired of the continuing, you know, Trump seizing every moment of the day with a new announcement. That they did seem to want more of a background president.
Well, exactly. But there was a way to sort of strike a happy balance that Biden failed to do. He went too far toward invisibility. He left too much to others to make his case for him. And when we think about the presidents who really dominate our imagination historically, the FDRs, the John F. Kennedys, even Ronald Reagan, who, you know, has his own cognitive issues, they're ones whose communicative skills and whose visibility really help them keep alive a certain message and tone and support throughout their tenure. And that's something Biden just wasn't up for.
And that was the assessment of David Greenberg, a professor of history and of journalism and media studies at Rutgers University. You're listening to the BBC World Service. This is NewsHour, coming to you live from London with James Kumarasamy. You're listening to the BBC World Service. This is NewsHour, coming to you live from London with James Kumarasamy. Let's get more now on our top story. Doctors in Tel Aviv saying that the three women hostages released by Hamas as part of a ceasefire deal with Israel are in a stable condition. Well, those three women are, of course, not the first hostages to be freed since the beginning of the war. Dr. Yael Moser-Glassberg was part of a team of doctors who treated the women and children who were released by Hamas 50 days into the war towards the end of 2023. And she told me what they had been like when they arrived at her hospital.
So when we received back then the hostages, the kids, it was 430 days ago. Think of it. It's crazy. So when we received them, we received kids with moms or kids on their own. Like the teenagers were alone without parents. The kids were very quiet. Very, very afraid. Pediatric patients, pediatric wards are very, you can hear cry, laugh, but there is voice. There is like, you, it's loud. You can hear life within the ward. The ward with the returned hostages were very quiet, and it was weird for us on the first day. And then every time we got back kids, we got used to it already that the first 24, 48 hours will be very, very quiet. And suddenly later on, they started to talk, they started to speak. They didn't whisper anymore, but they were whispering at the beginning because they were asked to whisper at captivity so nobody will hear them.
And their physical condition?
All of them returned with around 10 to 15% decrease of their body weight because of lack of food and starvation. All moms, all of them, without exception, all the mothers lost more percentage of their body weight than the kids because they gave up the food for their kids. Hygiene-wise, it was terrible. They came back infested with a lot of with lice, no shower, no hygiene for those 50 days. So the hygiene-wise was very bad. Infectious disease-wise, they had diarrhea and like vomiting and all kind of infectious diseases while in the Gaza Strip in captivity, as well as when they came back to us.
So what, I mean, your advice to doctors who are going to be speaking to them and examining them, and given your experience, what are the priorities, do you think, in these early hours and days?
So definitely the first thing is to see if there is an emergency medical situation that needs to be taken care of, and that will be done by all hospitals, all the adult wards that will treat them. If there is any medical emergency needed to be taken care of directly, and then if not, stay there, stand, listen, don't talk, absorb. And try to create a situation where they will feel comfortable, safe, and they will start talk. you know, one of the kids returned the day after, more than 24 hours after his return. We sat together at the small cafeteria that we built it within the ward, and he had, you know, like a quarter of a pita bread in his hand, and he didn't bite it. He didn't give in even one bite to this pita bread. And I asked him, why don't you eat? So he looked at me, and he's a 4-year-old. Okay. He looked at me and said, I'm keeping it for tomorrow. So it's very sad. It's difficult days now.
Dr. Yael Moser-Glassberg there. Well, the three Israeli hostages released today will also need hospital care. One of the hospitals preparing to take hostages in the next few weeks is the Shamir Medical Center just outside Tel Aviv. We can speak to Dr. Osnat Levtzion Korach, who is the general director and CEO of that medical center. Welcome back to NewsHour. And we spoke earlier today on an earlier edition before the hostages were released. I wonder what your thoughts, emotions were when you saw the images of the three women.
Of course, I couldn't stop my tears from pouring. It was so moving to see them and to see them on their feet. So it was a very, very happy moment. And unfortunately, we have very few happy moments since October 7th. And since the tragedy that we had here, and are still in it, because we need to remember that those three hostages came back today after 471 days in tunnels in captivity, subject to starvation, to ongoing threatening, to violence, to sexual violence.
Absolutely. But given all that, what did you make of their condition? I mean, they seemed remarkably well from a distance.
Right, I agree, and I was very, very happy because we did not know what to expect. So first of all, it was a very happy moment to see that they're on their feet. I'm sure they have many, many medical problems, but the good thing is that they're on their feet and they look stable. So for now, first of all, they can reunite with their families and their friends. They're in the hospitals, given their privacy, and there's no rush in doing all the further testing that they'll go on and start with tomorrow, probably.
But we did see quite clearly one of them, Emily Damari, seems to be missing some of her fingers. Do we know what happened there?
Well, what they say here is that she lost them on October 7th while she was shot by the terrorists.
And she's been living in those conditions, missing those fingers with a pretty serious wound for more than a year.
Correct, which of course we don't know how it was treated, and I'm sure it will be taken care of better now.
Now, just tell us briefly, if you can, what kind of preparations you are making to receive hostages in the coming weeks.
So first of all, the idea is that you have to keep their privacy, because everyone wants to know. Everyone wants to know the details, but no. So it's a private place. We cleared one of the wards, made it very nice. It's a remote place in the hospital. The idea is that we are treating them holistically. So there's a small team for each returnee, and the team consists of a psychologist, a psychiatrist, a doctor, a nurse, social worker, a dietitian, which is extremely important in this condition. And this team will follow and will be with the patient from the arrival till the end. So we're not mixing teams. They won't see many staff, because the idea is really to keep it, called a capsule, to keep it very, very intimate. The other thing is we have the physical thing. We have one of the things that we're very scared of is this, because of the severe malnutrition, is the refeeding syndrome. So there's a specific protocol that will be adjusted to each person. Yes.
We have to leave it there, but thank you so much for joining us again, Dr. Osnat Levtzion Korach, General Director of the Shamir Medical Center just outside Tel Aviv. And that brings us to an end of this edition of NewsHour from all of us here. Thanks very much for listening.
The Global News Podcast brings you the latest on the ceasefire and hostage release. We hear from our correspondent in Tel Aviv, where three Israeli women just released by Hamas after 15 months in captivity are being taken to hospital for medical checks. From the West Bank, where dozens of Palestinians held in Israeli prisons are being released. And from Gaza, as people return to what's left of their homes to rebuild. Find us wherever you find your podcasts.